Mackenzie, it has been a morning for you. It's funny, you had a housewarming party yesterday, and we were bragging about how we had never missed a week of recording. And of course, today you had a lot to go through to be here. So why don't you tell everybody the sacrifices you've made to be on the pod today?
Yeah, it's been a whirlwind, man. So as you know, yes, we did have a housewarming and a cookout wherein I could not eat anything because we believe, got some contaminated food somewhere this last week. We won't call out any names, but a certain establishment,
Mr. McDonald.
Miss no. Certain establishment may or may not have poisoned me is the point. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. This morning, I was so dehydrated. I decided, a friend of mine used to do this, so I got a referral from her. Decided to do one of those mobile IVs. Have you ever encountered those before?
I mean, I know of them, but I've never done them.
Did you know that this is like a trend? This is a trend. Like they do this for like bachelorette party hangovers and like bachelor party hangovers. This is a trend where they
They
will
just have
come.
a next morning
They have a
second party
next
where it's an
morning.
IV party and mimosas.
Brunch and a banana bag. That's literally
There you
what it
go.
is.
Okay.
So yeah, it's kind of crazy. But anyways, my nurse actually came from one of those this morning, so I thought that was hilarious. But I booked one of those because she referred me to this place, and I was like, perfect. I'm so dehydrated, and I am like really good about hydration normally, and I can feel it. So I was like, well, I haven't been able to keep anything in. I need some hydration, yada yada. She comes. It's all going great. I start to get a little itchy. Start to feel a little
Oh
funny. And I'm such a typical woman patient. We will not go down that road, but I'm just like, I'm fine. It's fine. Like, I don't need to say anything. And then she's about to leave. Like, she's about to take it out of my arm. And she looks at me and she's like, you doing okay? I
no.
guess I must have looked weird. And I was like, you know, I'm a little itchy. Like, I feel itchy. And she's like, you feel itchy? Like, how long have you felt itchy? And so we went down this whole rabbit hole. Anyway, long story longer. I was breaking out in hives from one of the vitamins that we added to the saline bag. And we still don't know what it is, but I have an allergy, apparently, to one of these vitamins. And yeah, who doesn't love to learn about a vitamin allergy? Trial by fire, I guess, was the way to learn about this today.
Well,
So,
I'm stealing long story longer because I love that. And yeah, I'm stealing that phrase because I tend to be a little long-winded when I'm telling stories. It's all about the details, man. You got to get the
It is,
details right.
man. You
So,
got to pepper them in.
yeah, those of you who listened to last week's episode on Black Panther heard my 10-minute tale of my doomed airline flight. And I realized listening back to the edit, I was like, shit, I went for a while on it. But at the end, the details matter. They're important,
The details matter. You got to pepper them in. She was great. She was really lovely. We were making jokes. Like I had, I had the inhaler puffed out, ready to go. We were having a great time. So the best part though is that she had to intravenously give me Benadryl so I could all calm down and all of that.
Didn't even know that was an option. Okay.
Yeah, so that makes you a little loopy. And it also puts you to sleep potentially. I am not yet tired, but that's why I said, nope, we're going to go ahead and pod because I got to power through this before I potentially pass out. And yeah, so we're here and I'm going to sound, I'm going to sound a little loopy today. I feel a little funny, but I think it's going to be a fun, I think it'll be a fun one for that
Yeah,
reason.
dude. And the streak continues. I don't remember at the very beginning. I feel like we might have missed a week in like the first month when we were still figuring out our schedule. But ever since we started doing like Wednesday's releases, I don't think we've missed. So the streak continues. Either way, whatever. Go look
I
it
don't
up if you
think we
guys want to be
ever,
assholes. But I feel
I
like we're
don't,
doing pretty well.
yeah, I don't think we ever missed a week. I think we pushed a day. You know what I mean? So yeah, I think we're doing great. I'm pretty proud of us. And I couldn't let us snap our streak right after we fucking,
We were talking shit.
we were talking shit. So.
Yeah. Well, you're the real heroes. Let's get this thing started.
Welcome back to We Drink and We Watch Things. I'm Mackenzie on
I'm
Benadryl.
Lamar.
Sorry, I
I'm
just
not
went
on
with
any
that.
drugs.
Sorry, I
Wish I
just wanted to
was.
pepper that into the intro this time. Anyway,
I'm just high on life.
there you go. And this week we are continuing our month of Juneteenth celebrations, which Juneteenth is actually this week from when we're recording because we're behind, yay. And we are, if you have not been here yet for this month, featuring Black filmmakers of all kinds, writers, directors, actors, etc. And this one's a special one because we wanted to work in the Pride aspect of as well as for this month, which I know June is always Pride Month, and we love that. But I feel like Juneteenth is a new-ish holiday for June. So I thought it was cool for us to focus on that. Obviously, this has been around for ages, but people have not really celebrated it and talked about it as much as they have in the last few years. So this was a fun opportunity to combine both with the Best Picture winner, Moonlight.
Controversial Best Picture. Well, not controversial in like the quality of the film, but can you tell us a little bit? Can you explain, as somebody who watches the Oscars every year, what the fuck happened the year that La La Land got announced, but then it turned out this was the real winner?
I feel like you just did it. You just stole my thunder, friend. No.
That's called queuing you up. I'm queuing you up. That's an industry term.
Following your cue, yes, for those of you who did not watch this travesty in action, we had a Best Picture presentation the year that this won, 2017 for 2016 films, and the announcers were given the wrong envelope, is what it comes down to, and it said La La Land, but it was for a different category. But they were up to announce the Best Picture category, and instead of like double checking before they said it, they saw the wrong category and they still announced La La Land, which was a bit controversial because those two were kind of neck and neck, but this was an all Black cast. So it was all people of color. Yeah. So it like had this split second of course they didn't win, like a frustration, anger, all these things. And then a stage manager had to run onto the stage and they all, like all these producers of the Oscars had to let them know that it was the wrong one, give them the right one, basically rip it out from under the La La Land crew and cast, which of course you feel for, and re-announce Moonlight, which was the real winner and was incredible. But yes, very, very sad and hard for your big moment to be overshadowed by this mistake. Yeah.
I remember there was like a little bit of drama. This is probably manufactured drama. It's just people being angry online, as people do. So I don't agree with this take at all. But I remember there being some drama of like, oh, we have this very progressive story with an all Black cast, and it's also, you know, LGBTQ plus, like all this stuff. And meanwhile, you have this other movie that's all mostly a white cast, and it's about a white guy co-opting jazz and teaching the world jazz. That's the way people presented it. I don't think that's La La Land's intent, but it was this going into the Oscars, these two films that were very different. So when that happened, it just seemed like another.
They were definitely juxtaposed against each other as like the people of color film versus white people film. And they were both, by the way, incredible fucking movies. I was very torn personally. I loved them both for all very different reasons. But I completely understand like how you would feel in that moment to lose out to that. But I also feel for the La La Land crew who had this like split second of they won and then it gets taken away. It's so much worse than just losing, I think. But Moonlight absolutely deserved to win, which we will get into in just a second. But before we go down that road, I'm obviously not drinking because Benadryl, banana bag.
Well, you drank already today. Yeah, you had your drink. You had your post-bachelorette drink.
Exactly. So what are you drinking? You made a fun cocktail today.
Yeah, I made a fun one. I need to start giving credit to the folks on the subreddit cocktails. And this is from user strong discussion 564. So mixed up 2 ounces of Empress gin, 2 ounces of coconut milk, 1 ounce of blue curacao, and 0.5 ounces of simple syrup. And it's this beautiful like milky blue color, which is really cool. And it's sort of a reference to the film. Mm-hmm. As some of you might not know, Moonlight was originally going to be a play. So this was a story, a concept by the co-writer on this, and he was trying to build it as a play. It never actually got produced, but the play was called In Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue. And that line gets stated in this film and sort of referenced in the ending as well. So figured it made sense to have a nice blue cocktail here. And we'll just call this Moonlight. Do you have a better name than that? It doesn't really have a name on the Reddit. So I guess we'll just.
I would honestly maybe just call it blue because Mahershala Ali's character.
Juan.
Yeah. Thank you. I was escaping me. Juan's character. He's like, so your name is Blue? And I always just thought that was so cute the way he said that because he's just, you know, a little boy who barely talks. I don't know. I think blue is fun.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll push them together. We'll call it like Blue Moonlight. How about that?
There you go.
A little bit of both.
A little bit of both. All righty. Well, I like it. Cheers to you.
Cheers to me.
Here's my water cheers. IV bag, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would be awesome if you had still had the IV bag attached and you could cheers with that. That'd be good for the socials.
Another fun nugget before we get into this is Lamar got to find this out in real time because I was actually late to record the pod. So he was in the studio waiting for me and I joined with my nurse and an IV bag and introduced him to let him know what was going on. So yeah, it's been a fun one.
Yeah, we almost had a special guest today. But
I know, we should have cheersed then. It would have been a great moment. Anyway, all right, guys. Well, as you know the drill, hopefully by now, if you've been here maybe once before, but if not and you're new, we are going to go through some of the basics of the film and we're going to try to do it fast because we end up in the weeds on this all too often. Yeah. We'll go through the basics and then we'll do a quick spoiler-free rating because this is, I think, a little bit newer of a film, and not only newer, I think fewer people have seen it or have had the chance to see it yet. So right. We'll do a spoiler-free section and then we'll get into it. So, all right. This is, like we said, it's Moonlight and it was done in 2016 and very highly rated. I mean, again, like I know a fair number of people have seen this, but I also know a fair number of people who haven't. Mm-hmm. But those who have, it's very well rated. So it's a 7.4 out of 10 on IMDb. It's 98% from critics, which is, of course, quite a feat. And then 79% from audience, which is, again, still very high, especially for kind of a tough subject matter. I think it's a beautiful film, and I think it, you know, spoiler alert, ends on a level of hope. But it is kind of a rough film. So I love when the audience like recognizes that something can be challenging and still great at the same time.
It's one of those ones where I think it's a very important movie. It's similar to Do the Right Thing. It's an uncomfortable film to watch, but I think it's socially very important and it's everyone should see it once. I didn't on rewatch, I found not flaws, but on rewatch when I know where the story is going, I have some critiques later on, but I think first time watchers will really get a lot out of this.
Yeah, I think it's beautiful. And I think it is something that actually, unlike some of these other challenging films that we've said, like are really hard to rewatch, I think it is rewatchable. That's, I think, the big difference. I think this is a rewatchable film and that you do catch more things and you can find, I think, a deeper meaning in it. So I think this was my third time seeing it. And yeah, I felt like I still got something new out of it on this watch as well. So anyway, this is directed by Barry Jenkins, which you may know him from If Beale Street Could Talk. He also directed an episode of the TV series of Dear White People, which was originally a film, fun fact, was also really good. And then he's been a producer on a lot of things that I think people have heard and seen as well, including After Sun, which was also an Oscar-nominated film. So he's got the magic touch. I'm just saying, this is a brilliant director. He's done some really great stuff. Brilliant director, writer, producer. So kind of a one-man show.
Nice.
He also wrote this, speaking of, along with Terrell Alvin McCraney, who, to Lamar's point in earlier, he wrote the play, the unproduced play. And he actually wrote that in his MFA program, which is cool. Huh. He was kind of trying to shop it out and get it produced. And like you said, it did not get produced. But that
I think the MFA product. That was interesting about the play was that it was originally written jumping between the points of Sharon's life, whereas the film, it's distinctly, you know, the first act, the second and the third are the three different time periods. The play was originally written to be sort of jumping between all of those time periods throughout. And maybe that's part of the reason why it didn't really work as well. I guess that could be visually kind of cool in a play, but in a film, I think it does make, just from seeing the movie alone, I think it makes a lot more sense going chronologically.
I actually think maybe that's why it didn't get produced as a play specifically, because like in theater, having done theater for a long time, it is very hard to show time transitions back and forth like that. So I could see that being a limitation. But yeah, I think it's a very clean structure with the three acts. I really like that. So anyway, major cast and crew, we're going to go through a few of these. Mahershala Ali, who I'm sure you have seen or heard of. He is tall drink of water, that man. And he's been in a few things. He's been in Green Book. He's done the voice on Spider-Verse.
Uncle Aaron.
And then he did Eternals He's also in Hidden Figures.
Well, he had a really small part in Eternals. He literally, you only hear his voice, and it's in one of the end credits scenes. And he's rumored, well, he's not rumored, he's confirmed to be playing Blade in the new version of Blade, but it just keeps getting pushed back. They teased it in Eternals, and now it's been, what, 4 years, 3 years? Yeah. And we still haven't seen anything else, so.
I think they feel like enough people didn't like Eternals that they were like, eh, they won't remember that. I digress. But he also is in Hunger Games. Anyway, he's done a bunch of great films and he's always great.
Yeah. And he won Best Supporting Actor for this with only about 20 minutes screen time, which is bonkers. Mm-hmm. Do you know, this was my fun fact that I had to confirm earlier, do you know who the actor or actress who's won an Oscar with the shortest amount of screen time is? I know you're a big film nerd, so any guesses?
I don't know who would be the shortest amount of screen time, but I always feel like Meryl Streep can win with just appearing physically.
There's some folks, yeah, on the Meryl Streep train, like Judi Dench had a really short role at some point, and she for like 14 minutes of screen time, and she won. So there's definitely people who can come in and steal a scene in the way that Mahershala Ali does. But it's Beatrice Straight in the movie Network in 1976. I don't know if you've seen that one.
Haven't seen it.
But she won Best Supporting Actress with only 5 minutes and 40 seconds of screen time, which is crazy.
Nice. Yeah, you know, when you just come in and steal the scene, as you said, like it makes an impact. And he does that here, and we'll get into why I think that is, because I feel like I've said this before on the pod about another few other films. I feel like when somebody's nominated for an Oscar, you can like see the moment that they earned it sometimes.
Yeah,
you
know what I mean? Like one great monologue or yeah
and you're like, there it is, okay. Yeah, this is an Oscar level performance, right? And I think he absolutely earned it here as well. So Naomi Harris, and she was in Skyfall, Inspector. So I'll quiz you. I don't know if you're a Bond fan. Who did she play?
I'm not a huge Bond fan, so I'll say that. But I know that I know some characters in Bond, so I'm going to guess she played James Bond. Did she play James Bond?
Don't we wish? James Bond needs to be a woman at this point. Let's go.
They did like a new 007 on the last Bond film, but then it was kind of like a twist where she was 007, but James Bond was still there. He just had a different call number. I didn't actually see it. I just knew that was, again, controversial with people that have too much fucking time on their hands.
Yeah, we won't go down that rabbit hole. But yes, she played Moneypenny. If you're a Bond fan, Moneypenny. Okay. She's great. Yeah. She was also in Southpaw. She also plays like an oracle type of person in Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End. And she's does a really cool turn in that one. Anyway,
I recognized her from one of the films that we almost did in the month where we were suggesting movies that one of us hadn't seen. Your options were Dawn of the Dead 2004, which you loved, and then 28 Days Later. And she is actually in 28 Days Later. I forget what her name is, but she's great in that, super strong, badass chick in that movie.
She's awesome. She does a great job. And fun fact, she shot all of her scenes in this film in 3 days. Because she's actually a British citizen, and there was like a visa issue and all of that. So she had to like get in, get out. It was crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And next up we have Trevante Rhodes, who you probably don't know him from as many things. He plays the oldest version of our main character here in the film. And he was in the US versus Billie Holiday, and Bird Box are a couple that people may have seen and seen him in. And he does, like I said, he's the last segment of this character. And then we have a couple others that also did this character, which is Ashton Sanders. And he's a little bit younger, doesn't have as many credits. You would probably know him from Judas and the Black Messiah, which was also an awesome film.
Yeah, also in Straight Outta Compton, which I think I've mentioned every week for like 2 months at this point.
I feel like you just watch that movie over and over. You're like ready to drop it every time
Turns out Straight Outta Compton is my favorite movie. Who knew?
Who knew? Alex R. Hebert, he was in Code Switch and Black Panther, two of his bigger ones.
Yeah, we called that out last week, his little tiny role yet. But he has like two lines of dialogue at the very end of Black Panther. So
yeah, he's important. Things. Anybody who gets dialogue in a Marvel movie with 27,000 people in it, that's an important role.
Yeah.
And then finally, Janelle Monáe, I wanted to mention, who I think is amazing in this, as she is in everything. This woman can do anything and everything. Not only is she super talented actress, she's done Hidden Figures, Knives Out, Glass Onion. She also, of course, is a musical artist, as a lot of you probably know, and like fashion icon. Sidebar.
Yeah. Random, also sidebar. I saw Janelle Monáe live. Some of you might know that I worked for the incredible company Hot Topic for a decade of my life. Loved that job. Oh my God,
this is Lamar. Like every week you also work in Hot Topic. It's Straight Outta Compton and Hot Topic. Those are your two.
If I can leave a lasting legacy, that should be it. But they would fly all the store managers out to LA for a weekend every October for kind of like our sales kickoff for the year. So it'd be 600 Hot Topic store managers, and we would see the new merch for the holiday season and all that stuff. But they would also bring out live music performers, and very often they were surprises. We didn't know who was coming, so I got to see lots of incredible music artists. But one year, they were like, oh, this is a young up-and-comer. Her first album's coming out in like 2 months, and it was Janelle fucking Monáe. So she came out, and just her stage presence there, when she's gonna do big things, because she just owned the crowd, dancing around the stage, played with a live band, really cool. So yeah, she was an incredible music artist, and now she's a really good actress as well.
Yeah, and she's one of those, again, she steals a scene, you know. She's on the screen and you're just glued to her face, and it doesn't hurt that she has a gorgeous fucking face too. Yeah, so but in general, she is just, she has an energy, she has an aura that's beautiful. So anyway, I also wanted to call out another one that, again, we don't do this enough, and this is my fault, but it was so important to me as part of this film that I wanted to make sure and mention it, which is the score. The composer of this film was Nicholas Britell. You can hear how he changes the music throughout for these different phases of Sharon's life, and it's awesome. And anyway, this is a beautiful score, so I wanted to make sure and call him out here. And we're going to give you a quick plot summary, spoiler free, don't worry. And this one is another one taken from IMDb, short, succinct, to the point. It is a young African-American man grapples with his identity and sexuality while experiencing the everyday struggles of childhood, adolescence, and burgeoning adulthood. So I feel like that's, again, so concise but accurate. I mean, he has all these layers to this struggle, but he's also just a kid trying to grow up and go through all the normal struggles we've gone through, but he has these added layers of difficulty, of course, that just, you know, make it really, really challenging.
Yeah. And it's very complex. I feel like we've used that word a lot this month. Mackenzie and I had talked of, would it make sense to bring someone, because as we said in our Do the Right Thing episode, we haven't lived these experiences. Neither of us are Black. Like, we are not going to get on a soapbox about these social issues that we have no context on, except as outsiders. But we had talked about the possibility of, would it make sense to bring one of our friends on who has had those experiences to sort of speak to one of these films? And we were like, there's pros and cons. People are going to interpret it different ways, but we didn't want to force something and be like, well, we're only bringing them in because we're doing Juneteenth. And that seemed like a weird thing to do. So we opted not to. This is one where I really rewatching it, I'm like, I really wonder what the perspective of Black men watching this film and Black women, whether depending on your sexuality, because I'm sure this landed with Black gay men, for example. I don't know how it would land in the Black community. And I think that's something that I'm really curious to dig into. So anybody out there that's listening that can, you know, educate me a little bit, I am curious to know, because it is an all Black film, but obviously it's a bit not controversial, but, you know, it's our country's 50-50 on whether this movie is quote unquote controversial or not, I guess. But I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on that, you know, enlighten me.
I think it's, you know, another just logistical tidbit is that our schedules are really difficult as it is. So I think we also felt chaotic. It was untenable to actually add a person. But also, I think the thing for me here is that it is divisive within that community, but it also is divisive, again, not as a Black person, but in the Latin community as well. And like, there is a machismo, an anti-gay, a homophobia that is prevalent and rampant in our community, and it was in my own family. Like, I have a queer and I have a lesbian cousin, both of whom I'm very close with, and they went through some similar type of behavior from their own families, like not really accepting them. And so I think it can resonate with people who can identify with certain aspects of this story. At least that was my read on it, even though, again, not being in this exact circumstance, you cannot possibly relate to all of this. But there are things I think that everyone can, either you or somebody you know, can potentially relate to. So,
I mean, you could watch, I don't have to be a female to watch Lady Bird and relate to that character in some way of her coming of age story. So I think it's the same thing here.
You don't have to be a female empathize. To watch Barbie and go on a feminist yeah. rant, you know, like that.
I've done it dozens of times.
You've done it dozens of times.
Yeah, you can have empathy for characters just because they're not 100%, you know, in line with your life doesn't mean that you can't empathize.
Right. So all that to say, I think this is super valuable and super relatable in that this, again, is a coming of age story, and some of those core struggles at the very least everyone can, I think, relate to, is that just mm-hmm. trying to figure out who you are, which I think is a big theme of this film. Yeah. But a couple production nuggets. It was a really teeny, teeny, tiny budget. And really, if you account for inflation, the smallest budget of any Best Picture winner ever. The yeah. next closest was Rocky, but if you account for inflation, they actually had a higher budget than this. And mm-hmm. it was $1.5 million. And they did 64.2 against that, which is, you know, it's not Marvel level, but it percentage-wise killed their budget, knocked it out of the park. But it was a very, very well-received film, like we said. So it's awesome. And yeah. then...
And we said the word important earlier, and I think that ties into this as well. If this was not only A24's first Best Picture win, they now have Everything Everywhere All at Once. But those movie nerds nowadays, like myself and Mackenzie, who are like, oh, anything with A24, I'll almost always go see because I know they make great shit. And this was their first Best Picture win. So important to them and also important in the communities we talked about. This was the first all-Black cast and LGBTQ+ film to win Best Picture. So again, an important film.
Oh, yeah, I was going to mention that. So like right in line with our theme today. So yeah, it did both, and that's amazing. So spoiler-free, though, what's your rating? I mean, we've said important. We've said all these things already. We've already gone overboard on the basics. But what would you say is your rating for coming in before we get into the spoilers?
I think on my first watch, again, I really enjoyed this one. It's a tough watch, but it has good lessons. And like you said, I think it does provide some hope and overall positive message at the end. So I think it's socially a very important film, but it is one of those where for me personally, I heard you say you've watched it three times. Once was enough for me on rewatch. I think it drags a little bit in that last act. So I'd give it like a 7.5. I think it's a very important film, but it's not one of my personal favorites. But that first watch through, it did hit me pretty hard. So I'd say like a 7.5.
I'd go like 8.5 because mm-hmm. I can't land at a hard number ever. but I think there's some real poetry to this film. And I think the quote unquote slowness is very intentional. And I think it reads really well, which again, we'll get into it. So yeah, I'd go 8.5. But as we like to say on the pod, turn around, don't drown. It's spoiler time. All right. Well, as we said, this film occurs in 3X, and which is very much like a play. And that's how you can tell, yeah. like you, to your point, that the source material is a play, right? And I think it's beautifully done and beautifully translated. I like that they changed it to chronological order. I think the stark shift in his phases of his life are really important as well. But we start off at this first phase, first act, which a couple little things happen before the beginning of each act being announced, but it kind of sets the stage. And he's very small. He's this adorable, cute little boy, and he is called Little. For that mm-hmm. reason, like he's kind of a small guy, and you learn that his name is Sharon, but everybody calls him Little. And I think that becomes kind of a running theme for him, is like, it's kind of a term of endearment, but it is used also as an insult. And he offers it up also. He's like, but everybody calls me Little, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's part of his identity at this stage that he is Little. He's smaller and all these things, but it opens up in this community, Liberty City, Miami area. It's a very impoverished area of that city in real life. And fun fact is where the director, Barry Jenkins, grew up. So this is loosely based on, some of the characters are loosely based on folks that they knew, but it is of course fictionalized, but the community is supposed to be very representative of the place that he grew up, essentially. And you open up on this scene where you see a lot, and Mahershala is our kind of our big exposure to this drug scene. His character Juan mm-hmm. is a drug dealer. You learn that very quickly, but he's one of those who and I think this, we'll get into it, but this is a very cyclical film. I the way I see it is very, talks about these cycles of your lives and in this mm-hmm. community. And he is this drug dealer, but he is also, you can tell, a good guy, a good man. You get that impression from him like right away, you know, that he exudes that, I think.
Yeah, I got big time The Wire vibes, at least in the first act of this film. And he reminds me a lot of Omar Little from The Wire, where it's this complex character of, yes, he does these terrible things. You know, you don't really see much of his, I don't think you see really any violence from him or anything like that. But you know that with the way that all of his soldiers, for lack of a better term, or his dealers have that respect, and almost the people in the community have this fear of him, you know he does some bad shit. But I think it is intentional of them not putting that visually on screen, but just his presence speaking for itself. And yeah, I think Juan is just interesting to watch. As you said, he's charismatic, he's confident, he's kind, and he just seems like this. I'm wondering, and this was a question I was going to ask you, was I feel like a lot of scenes in this film, because of the subject matter, it almost feels like anytime there are two males sharing screen time, whether they're in a car together or sitting down for food, there always seems to be this sort of like sexual energy like running underneath it. And I don't know if that's just me as a viewer reading into it, but we'll get into more of that in like the second and third act. Of it sort of perpetuates this entire film. And I had that feeling of, why does this drug dealer Juan, why is he more accepting of this? And is there any of that energy of like, maybe he's had experiences in the past? So I was going to run that by you and see if you got those similar vibes or not.
I didn't get those vibes from him personally. I don't think he's the one who is closeted, but I do think there are others that come up, right? And that is situational. That is cultural. There is no safe space for a gay person in this community, especially as a man. Mm-hmm. And there is severe homophobia in this community. And Juan is the only one from a male perspective that we see reject that homophobia, reject that reality. And I think that's why you sort of see of like, that's, there's that question mark of, does he potentially feel the same way? But I don't think so. I don't think he's intended to. No, I think he's an ally and he's an anomaly in that way. But I think it comes back to just his, again, being just a good guy. But I think that he is looking out for Sharon. So Sharon gets chased.
Oh, I think it's, Mark, I think it's Chiron. I think I started by saying Sharon, but I think it's Chiron, isn't it?
I keep saying Sharon because, that's the name of the ferryman who carries you across the river Styx in Greek mythology. And like, that's how I have it in my head. So apologies, but they don't say his name a lot actually either. So it's hard
because
to hear
three
how,
different, yeah.
Right. So it's hard to see, hear how they pronounce it, but I think they pronounce it differently. How was it?
I think it's Chiron. And I mispronounced it to start the pod. So I probably put you on a path. I didn't do it because of mythology. I just did it because I'm ignorant.
I did it because I'm a nerd, but you know, whatever, each to each their own. But yeah, so I think it's Chiron, but they, again, in this phase, they just call him Little. But he is getting chased by these bullies. They're already, you see from this very first take with him, they are chasing him, they're bullying him, they're calling him the anti-gay F word mm-hmm. that we don't want to say. They are already identifying something in him that is different. Yeah. And you can see, which I think speaks so much to like, this is not a choice, right? Like this is just how this person is and they're judging him for it. And he's just this adorable, terrified little boy. And he escapes into what they call in this film, a dope hole, where it's somewhere where, you know, crackheads hang out and they do drugs. And he is hiding in there. Like, how horrible is this situation that that is the only place to escape? Right. You know, and I think that says a lot and is intentional about giving you the lay of the land here. I think it's trying to tell you the circumstances that this kid is growing up in and the challenges that he faces. And then Juan comes in and tries to save him from that. He's like, I want to get this kid out of this area. And he doesn't want him, you can tell, to fall prey to what everyone else in this area, this immediate area, you know, ends up in, the road that they go down.
Yeah, I think what you said about there's just no safe space for him in this area. So you know, thank goodness for one. And I mean, I taught middle school for 4 years on a pretty difficult campus, and middle schoolers are fucking cruel, man. So
they're horrible. This is they're the worst, actually. Yeah. Forget high school. Middle schoolers are the worst.
So yeah. So if you think this is in any way exaggerated of like, they wouldn't know that he was gay and they wouldn't be making fun of him at this, yes, they would. And so parents, just raise your kids, right? Help them empathize, please. Just coming from a former middle school teacher.
Yeah, 100%. And we're not going to spend a ton of time on each section. Like we said, I think there's some core events. I think one of the core, there's a couple core events in this initial section for Little, which is he has this one friend in Kevin who mm-hmm. does not seem to reject him, who mm-hmm. seems to be trying to give him the lay of the land of how to survive. Because you can tell that he is of mixed race, but he is a person of color, and he's trying to help him figure out, like, how do you survive in this situation? You can't let them know that you're soft, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that is what Kevin is figuring out and doing more successfully than Little. And so he's trying to let him know, like, you need to just show them you're hard, like, right?
Stick up for yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. And they have this wrestling match, mm-hmm. which is, to your point, I do think there is some sexual tension there, in that what are they figuring out in that moment? Mm-hmm. Are these boys playing and just like being silly, or are they realizing something about themselves in that moment? Right. And I think that that's done very loosely, very intentionally, not with any overt sexuality, because they are very young. So I don't think it's inappropriate in any way, but I think it does make you question, what is Little figuring out in this moment? Right. And I think the other big piece of this first act is his mom. You know, his mom mm-hmm. is kind of a mixed bag to start. You see these moments of her being kind to him, but you also see these moments of her going down this hole of drugs. And mm-hmm. the added complication of this, which I think is so core to this first act, is that Juan, who's trying to protect Little and save him from this, and he's introduced him to his girlfriend and made his home a safe space. Him and Teresa have made this a safe space for him. They are the ones selling, really, Juan is the one selling the drugs, right? It's his drug ring that his mom is taking, that Little's mom is taking and is completely addicted to. And that struggle of, I am providing the supply mm-hmm. as a way for me to survive, but I don't want this mother to create a bad home life for this little boy that I care about. Yeah. But I also can't change this other part of me. And I think that is the huge conflict in this act. And it is for Little too, where he asks him outright, do you deal drugs? And he doesn't lie. I have that note in here so many times of how relentlessly honest and open mm-hmm. Juan is to Little. And he asks him outright and he says, yes. And he says, my mom takes drugs, right? And he's connecting those dots. Like, you're yep. the person that is supplying her. You're why she's so bad. And Juan says yes. And that's the moment that I was talking about, where I'm like, that performance from Mahershala Ali in that moment is like so profound. I could tear up right now. You mm-hmm. can, this conflict that he is having within himself is profound. It's huge.
Yeah. I think it's very intentional that each of the first two acts sort of ends with a betrayal. And it again, mm-hmm. just to Chiron, it just seems like every person in his life that cares about it, with, I guess, the exception of Janelle Monáe's character, it just seems like anyone that he puts his trust into, he ends up getting his heart broken again. And obviously I feel like the two through lines through this entire film are his relationship with his mother, who, you pointed out that she did all her filming in 3 days, and mm-hmm. Naomi Harris, she's the only actor to appear in all three acts. So let that absorb of, she's the only actress who's in all three parts of this film, but did it all puts on an incredible performance. But the two through lines are his relationship with his mother and his relationship with Kevin. And so we see those early phases of it here, and obviously it's going to continue mm-hmm. to develop throughout the film. But yeah, that scene where Juan, again, he's a quote unquote good guy for all of that, and he's not going to mm-hmm. lie to the kid. But I think there's a reason that it cuts to it cuts hard there, of that is the end of this act, because it is just him realizing, this guy who has been teaching him how to swim and caring for him and feeding him and all these things, even this guy is contributing in some way to his life's hardships, right?
And he's the first to show him any level of acceptance. for his potential sexuality. I have the note that conversation that they have about the anti-gay F word, where he asks him what it means, again, all in the same scene, is, again, relentlessly honest, but also accepting. He asks him what it means, and he says, that's a word to make gay people feel bad.
Which I thought is the most,
I loved that explanation, because it's like, it's not actually, it's not a bad thing, but it is a bad word. It is a
word. Has anyone ever explained that word better than he does there?
And just so simply.
Yep,
so simply.
That's exactly what it is. It's just something that people say to make you feel bad.
Yeah. And I just love that whole conversation. And he asks him, but am I this? Mm-hmm. And he says, no, you could be gay, but don't let anybody call you that word. Like, there's nothing wrong with it. And I think that's such an important moment for him, because that is something he continues to struggle with. And this father-like figure, because he doesn't have a solid father figure, tells him this. But then, like you said, it's a 1-2 punch of, or really, I guess, a backhanded hit, where he then tells him that he is this drug dealer. And that's, like you said, it's this betrayal, but it's this honest, profoundly honest interaction. And you can tell it really breaks Juan's heart to be a part of this child's pain in any way. And he wants to make up for it. And I think you said the through lines are totally accurate. It's Kevin and his mom, but I think secondarily it's Teresa and Juan, because they were such a big part of his formative years. And while they don't appear in, both appear in the later acts, you know, Juan doesn't appear in act 2 or 3 and Teresa doesn't appear in act 3. Their influence is a through line as well. And I think it's an important note. But then we get into, speaking of act 2, where it's introduced as Chiron. And that's a 5-ish year jump is the implication. He's kind of in his awkward teenage years. And he's starting to be surrounded by these really aggressively heteronormative conversations and homophobic conversations. And he doesn't have, you know, a safe place at school, except for, again, in Kevin. But Kevin is also, again, participating in these heteronormative conversations and cultures, and making it, there's still a little bit of a gap between the two of them for that reason. You can tell Chiron is like, I'm not quite sure if I am safe here, if I can be myself with this person, but he's the only shot I have. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like he's his only reprieve at that point.
Yeah. I wrote down that I think the middle act, Kevin, might be the weakest of the actors in this, but I don't know how much of that is that high school bravado of the character, where he's clearly trying to come off as masculine as possible. And like you said, doing the heteronormative stuff, you know, he has that story where he says, oh yeah, I got caught having sex with a girl in the stairwell, but I talked my way out. I only got detention. It really makes me miss the days that you could, you know, have sex in a stairwell and only get detention for it and not the cops get called. But clearly that's a lie. And he's doing, so I'm not sure how much of it is that faux bravado, but I think that Kevin in the middle act is one of the weaker parts of the film personally.
I think he's just, I think it's a bravado thing. I actually think it plays well, because I think it's somebody who is also overcompensating, right? Like, they're both just figuring out how to survive in this situation, in this culture. And Kevin is doing a better job by having that extra bravado, right? By being aggressively, you know, out as a straight man. Mm-hmm. And that is, and not just that, but like a womanizer, right? Like, I'm going to really prove it. And I think that's intentional. I think it's a defense mechanism. And I think he does a good job in that way. But I love the, you know, Chiron's growth even in this period, right? And it's just one act of I have it in here so many times. I just want to hug him the whole time. Yeah. I just want to hold him and shield him and protect him the whole time. And nobody is looking out for him except for Teresa. Mm-hmm. And she is his safe space, and she is such a touchstone. And you can tell that him and Juan, even with that betrayal, had maintained a relationship. You don't see him here, but they had maintained a relationship. He had continued to be a father figure, and he was lost to presumably some kind of violence related to his drug dealing.
I like that they don't address that directly until, you know, 15, 20 minutes into this segment of the film. You notice he's not there, but no one says it. And there's even a scene where he and Teresa are making the bed and they say, oh yeah, something about Juan, but they don't outright say it. And I guess the studio wanted them to add a more direct line of like, oh yeah, remember when Juan passed, something very obvious, like exposition. And they said, no, like it's set in their faces because they're both great actors. So like, just let them tell the audience in this way.
And they do say it in this act. It
later,
just
yes.
Releases slowly in phases. It's mm-hmm. like since the funeral and you're not sure whose funeral, right? Mm-hmm. And then they say when Juan died, you know, like it takes a while to get that release. But I want to hone in on something you just said there. The script here is so sparse and so intentional. There is very little speaking in this film. Like this is the opposite of an Amy Sherman Palladino script, right? It is very concise, but I think it's so intentional. It is all about the performances. It is all about the tension and the environment and what these people are going through rather than language. And when words are spoken, they are poetic practically. Especially the scene on the beach with Kevin and him. They have this really deep conversation where they're truly connecting and letting some walls down. And they're truly saying it in a poetic type of way. And I think the words are so carefully chosen and so beautifully written throughout this film that that is actually kind of why it can feel like it drags, because there's not as much talking. There's a lot of you taking in non-verbal performances. Mm-hmm. And I think it's beautiful. I think it lands so well. And of course, just to get to that moment in this is, you know, he has his first sexual interaction. It is implied at all, but especially with a man. And that's with Kevin in this moment. And Kevin makes him, again, to the point of safety, feel kind of safe, feel kind of accepted. He's literally cradling him when this happens, you know, and they have this first kiss that is so beautiful. It's in the moonlight. It's on the beach. He looks a little blue, like to your point, like this hearkening back to that line in Act One. And it's a really beautiful moment. You're cheering him on for having this moment and letting this happen. And, you know, and they have this intimate connection that neither of them right after really talks about. Again, like there's not really, they don't really put words to it in this moment, but it's this beautiful connection and profound moment in both of their lives.
Yeah, I that moment, I thought the hand gripping the sand was a little much. Like, I didn't really need that shot. Like, we know what's happening. I guess it's meant to, you know, show sort of the heat of the moment. But I thought that was a little much. But then right afterward, I mean, who among us hasn't washed a, you know, post-sex hand off in sand? That makes a lot of sense. I was like, Kevin, what are you doing? But the moment that broke my heart was right after that moment where he's had this first and possibly only sexual experience, as we learned. I mean, there's hints of it later in the film where he's having, he's 30 something years old or 28 years old, and he's having wet dreams. Like, he's not having sexual activity much. So, and he tells Kevin later in the film of like, you're the only one that's touched me. And so, your heart breaks for him in this moment and later in the film. But when he apologizes, they have this moment and he says, I'm sorry.
Yep. And I hate that.
And that is just, rough.
I have that in my notes of like, don't say sorry. But I love that Kevin says that back to him. That's the thing. Kevin is the person who will push him and challenge him to like accept himself, you know? And he's like, what do you have to say sorry for? You know? But how crazy is this moment for an adolescent in general, but especially with all the things weighing on this particular dynamic, this particular person? You can all think back to your first sexual experience when you were younger and how exciting but anxiety inducing that was. And like there, if there was some level of guilt or shame, or if it felt totally normal but you were nervous about this person, like all these things, what does this mean, you know, all the normal adolescent anxiety of it all, but then it being a guy and a guy in a community that doesn't accept gay relationships, and it being, you don't know what happens after this, right? And you, and also being people of color, right, in communities that only allow this like machismo to exist, right? So it's such an interesting moment that you're happy that he's had, but also feels like a one-off situation for him. Feels like he's not going to have this again. He still has this shame, right? And then, of course, they have a fight, not a real fight, but Terrell, who's awful, homophobic. And this is the person I think is closeted, by the way. Terrell, the bully from school. I think he takes his rage at himself and what he cannot be out on Chiron, right? He doesn't, he's not in a position to accept his own sexuality either. And he also sees it in him, probably for some reason, right? And he is violently against it. And I think it is his own projection of his own pain. And he targets him for this reason. And he makes Kevin fight him. And it's because, you know, he is manipulating the situation and he wants to, I think, beat this out of this person. And by virtue of that, beat it out of him. And Kevin can't defend himself against this either. Like, Kevin blends a little better than Chiron, but he's also not quite in, you know? So he almost has to do this. And it's this face-off right after they've had this incredibly intimate moment. And he hits him and they all beat the shit out of him. And it's a huge, it's a turning point in Chiron's life.
Yeah, I didn't read it the same way. I just read it as Terrell's a fucking asshole. But I mean, I could see how you could interpret it that way if he's actually closeted and taking this out. And he's very manipulative and he's kind of like, you know, I'm trying to think of what the word, like the ringleader of this group. And he's giving orders and he doesn't want to fight himself because he doesn't want to get in trouble. So instead, he sends Kevin to do his dirty work and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. And it could be either one. Absolutely. That's the thing, is it can be just a bully being a bully. It can be that machismo of like this otherness. It can be truly homophobic and not also be homosexual like that. All these things can totally be true. But ultimate result is that, yeah, he pits these two against each other and Chiron cracks as a result of this. Right. And he
that
comes back
shot
the next-
in the ice bath, like the ice sink bath, and him looking at himself his in the face. Mirror with the cuts and the halogen lights. Like, I think that's one thing that flies under the radar in this film because everyone's so focused on how good the story is and how important that is. But there's some really good shots in this that opening sequence where the camera's spinning around Juan as he's like walking across the street and you're just enveloped in this world. And there's the shot of Naomi Harris in the pink light of the bedroom door, like screaming at Little. There's a lot of really pretty shots. And not, I mean, pretty is, you know, relative term, but just really well done shots, including that post fight. Like, and you're just like, something just snaps in him.
And again, a lot of it is nonverbal, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you don't hear in act one that she's yelling him, "You are a F word," but you can see it, but it's silent, but it's slow-mo. So you can interpret it and it's shot and it's muted in a very specific way. And then here again, they have this profound moment on the beach. And the only thing, you know, underpinning that is this incredible score. And then you have this moment where he's again looking at himself in the mirror and he's flipping a switch, right? He's like, this is the moment he turns hard, right? He realizes I can't survive if I don't get
hard. I can't
hard,
be myself.
Basically.
Yeah, I can't be myself.
I cannot be myself. I'm not going to survive being myself. And yeah, the way that it's shot, and again, it's all nonverbal, and he comes in and you have this long sequence of him not saying or doing anything, going through these millions of doors and you feel like it's never going to end. And then he gets through the door and he cracks that chair over Terrell. Mm-hmm. And that is the moment that changes his life. He's arrested. He goes to juvie and it was out of defense and it changes his whole perspective of he spends that time in juvie. And then we go into this phase three, this act three.
Before we get to act three, really quick, there's one shot that I was going to ask you about. When he gets arrested after that, Kevin is looking at him through the cop car window and he does this motion with his lips where I was like, is he blowing a kiss or is he just like blowing wind? Like, what is the, did you read into that at all? I didn't know what he was trying to say with that.
I don't know. I don't remember that actually in this moment. I'd have to go back and watch. I mean, I know he's looking at him, but I don't remember him.
It's a very subtle thing. He slightly opens his, but he, I was going to touch on this a little earlier when you mentioned it, but I love, you said the thing about very little dialogue in this. And I think it's hard sometimes when you're doing these, not coming of age tales, but these things that are interspersed across multiple time periods, and you're trying to maintain this same character and keep it believable that this is the same character through all these years, despite the casting changes and whatnot. And I think that that component of Chiron, where he doesn't talk, like he just instantly shuts down when people put him on the spot. And that happens through all three of these eras, including the one that we're about to get into. He doesn't talk. He's fed by other people three times in the, like every time, like people are feeding him because he's just like not taking care of himself, or he just looks hungry, I suppose. But I like that he stays the same throughout all three eras of this, despite outwardly changing in his appearance and the way that he approaches things.
Yeah, he absolutely makes these other shifts, but certain things don't change. And you see that in Act Three as well. When Act Three is Black, he takes on that moniker. You can tell that's the nickname that Kevin gave him, actually. And he kind of switches over to that persona. And Kevin tells him a couple times, you're exactly the same, but then also you're different, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's called out from people who know him over a long period as well. So that's a great call out. But yeah, Act Three comes in and he's made this shift, and it's all about who he is now. Like the personas that the persona he's had to create, again, to survive. Coming out of juvie, he meets someone in there who, of course, is not a great influence, but gives him a quote unquote opportunity, which you hear that come up earlier in Act One as well. The dealer on the corner is saying, thanks for the opportunity, right? So the implication is like, these are the opportunities that they have. And he is emulating almost exactly who Juan was. Right.
Even down to the lip licking. Yeah.
Yeah. And like the lip licking and the crown on the dash and the car and like the jewelry, you know, like he's trying to emulate the only father figure he's ever really had. Right. And he's also, again, adding that persona of that hardness. And you see that he's now a drug dealer as well. The thing that, you know, really took down his mom and their relationship and made his home life not safe. But he's in that situation. And, you know, it's heartbreaking to see that he's fallen down this same road, because this is the only way he feels at this point, especially with his history, that he can be successful.
Again, you know? Big time The Wire vibes. If anyone's ever not watched The Wire, go watch that TV series. But season four is all about the kids in school, and you see them becoming all these other archetypes that you've seen earlier in the series. And it's just like, when you're in that system and surrounded by this and you don't think there's any path out, more often than not, you just fall right back into that part of the system. You grow up to be the people that you hoped you wouldn't.
Yeah. And I think he feels shame about that, but I think he also has just built this wall up. And you can see that, this wall of, again, this is how I have to survive. And this is the circumstance that I'm in, and there's nothing I can do about it. And you know, and this call from Kevin, like, really breaks through, you know, you see it kind of shatter that armor for even just a quick second on the phone. And it puts the idea of Kevin and that one thing that he had obviously tried to forget for years back at the forefront for him. And something forces him to think about it, you know?
Yeah, the juxtaposition of, they have that conversation on the beach in Act Two where Kevin says something about, like, you know, it makes me so sad, it makes me want to cry. And Chiron says, you cry? And he goes, no, but it makes me want to. And then Chiron says, I cry all the time about all different stuff. When he's an adult, it's so disheartening to see that when Kevin calls him, and then later when they're talking face, he almost gets angry at the fact that he's crying. Like, he stops himself. He doesn't let himself cry anymore, because again, he's trying to emulate that sort of masculinity. And even when it's him by himself, he's sort of angry about the fact that he is crying.
Yeah. And I think, you know, he actually says it in this really, like I said, very poetic way in Act Two, where he says, should I cry so much? Sometimes I feel like I'm going to just turn into drops, you know, and it's beautiful and it's painful. And the last time he really sobs is at the end of that act. And that's another thing that he says, you don't even know, to the principal, and he starts to sob. And it's like everything that he means by that is rolled up in those tears, like how heavy everything is. It's not just this fight. It's all these other things. And you don't even know, you know, mm-hmm. and you can explain it, right? And I think that's here again of like, if I open up these floodgates, you know, I become weak again. I let all these things happen again. And you don't know. I have to lock that down. But he loves Kevin still in so many yeah. ways. Like, he has such a connection to him that this is the one person that, again, can kind of pierce that armor. And he's having, like you said, he's having these, you know, wet dreams like a teenager again. And he kind of reverts in this moment to this other version of himself. But it also lets him consider that version of himself. And I think that's so important for him to come back to, like, again, who he is the core question this whole film, right? And Kevin asks it of him too. Who are you, man?
Mm-hmm.
Like, and Chiron has tamped it down so hard that he doesn't really know, right? He's justifying his drug dealing to his mom, who is clearly trying to get clean. And that scene is so profound between the two of them of, you don't want to forgive her and neither does he, but he also does want to forgive her and he loves her and they love each other. But these drugs and these things that impacted their relationship can't be erased.
You can't undo that. You can apologize as much as you want to. And I think I'm seeing it through Chiron's eyes, and he's got these people in this third act. He has the two people who have hurt him the most in his life, giving him advice on how to be a better person. And I think that that is what you have to sort of reckon with as the viewer. Like you said, you want to, I don't want to forgive the mom because I'm like, you treated him like shit for decades. So you are not allowed to try and give him advice now, even though you are attempting to improve yourself.
Yeah. And it's hard to not give her some credit, right? Because she learned the hard way. Right. She mm-hmm. learned the hard way how bad this is. And now he's in this scene and he's propagating these same problems for other people by virtue of being involved. And also that there is this implication, of course, as there was with Juan, that there is no happy ending to this line of work, this business, right? It's only going to end poorly, whether it's for you or for someone else. And while are no shots fired in this entire film, the violence is on the edge of everything. Right? You can feel it on the peripherals of this whole film. And the implication is that he can be victim to it as well.
I'm sorry, but there's that shot. I had this in my notes because this ties exactly into what you were saying about the potential for violence. There's the shot of him in the diner at Kevin's diner. And he's sort of thinking through the speech that Kevin gave him about changing his life and whatnot. And when he was a kid, Juan told him, you know, you always want to sit facing the door so you can see whatever threats are coming in.
Right.
And in the diner, he's looking at the door and they zoom in and you see the door open and the bell rings. And it gave me hardcore like Sopranos finale vibes. I won't ruin it, but like same exact thing of like Tony Soprano's life is always going to be in danger. And I think that that's Chiron reckoning with that of, if I continue down this road, I will constantly be under threat.
Right. And I think that Kevin is also trying to reach him to say that too. Like, he's gone to prison as well. That's implied. They talk about it. And he's working this diner job. He's broke, but he's got a beautiful son as well. And he just says like, yeah, I got worries, man, but not the ones I used to have.
Right.
Totally different kinds of worries, right? Like, and that feels so good. And you see that smile and that optimism and that joy in his face that even though things are hard, they're not that kind of hard, right? And he's trying to get Chiron to see that there is another side to this that you can be on. And there, I think that the reason I said I think this ends on hope is that Kevin is hopeful. He's emblematic of this other side of this life. He's still accepting of Chiron and also trying to get Chiron to accept himself. And you also see Chiron open up and be the most verbal he's been throughout this film. And they're already like kind of flirting, right? Like, they're kind of leaning into this connection that they have. And you can tell that Kevin is, you know, bi or bi curious, or he's queer or what have you. There's no need to put a finger on it is the point. Mm-hmm. He's just accepting of who he is. And he wants Chiron to accept himself. And Chiron finally, to your point earlier, says, you know, you're the only person who's ever touched me. You're the only man who's ever touched me. And he just immediately cradles him the same way he did that first time. He hugs him and he makes him feel safe. And I just think that is what Chiron has wanted and wants at the end of the day, to be himself and simultaneously feel safe.
Yeah, it's the most powerful ending for the film. We don't need to see them fall in love. We don't need to see them going on a date or holding hands or even kissing. The most powerful way to end this is for him to, you know, admit to who he is, accept it, to have this moment of vulnerability, and just him resting his head on his shoulder and allowing himself to cry. Like, I'm getting emotional thinking about it, but it's a super powerful film moment.
It is. And the moment that I think the real, like, that is that comfort, that joy, that release of emotion, that performance is beautiful. But again, mm-hmm. speaking to the cyclical nature of this film, both in who he's trying to become and also who he was, the last thing you see is him as a little boy.
Mm-hmm. And in the blue moonlight.
In the blue moonlight. And in this place that he loved, the water and the beach and this. And I just see it as this moment of him coming back to himself and letting himself get in touch with that kid who there was nothing wrong with, mm-hmm. that little boy who was perfect as he was. And he's willing, it feels like, to consider and get in touch with that little boy again. And I think that's why it's so beautiful.
Yeah, totally agree. Powerful, powerful ending.
Powerful ending. Woof, man. I got chills. I love this movie. So like I said, I would give it like an 8.5. I love this film. Thank you for going into this one with me. I know it's a hard
one. Absolutely. No, and I wanted to call out because you don't get a lot of moments of levity in this film. Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard to make anything funny here. But I wanted to call out the beginning of Act 3 when he is sort of he becomes the ringleader of sort of the drug dealers in town there, and his guy's talking to him and he's talking about what girls he's may or may not be sleeping with. And the guy says, Aphrodisia. He says, where is she? She only comes out at night. And it's and like, apologies to all the Aphrodisias out there. But like, apparently Aphrodisia only comes out at night. I thought that was like pretty funny. And then I had the thought of when he is an adult and Kevin gets in touch and he goes to see him and he says, hey, I'm really sorry. And it's like, okay, again, you're apologizing after all this terrible shit. I thought he should have been like, okay, well, you hit me 4 times in the face when I weighed 100 pounds. In order for, you know, your comeuppance, I will hit you 4 times in the face when I weigh 225 pounds. Like, I was like, maybe he could get a little bit of redemption. They didn't go that route. I understand why the directors and writer didn't want to end on that tone, but yeah.
Yeah, I would say that wasn't the vibe, definitely, at the end. But, you know, I see what you're saying. We need to
let it. Now we're even. Now we can hang out.
Now we can hang out. Yeah. No, I think it ends on as hopeful a note as you can get, to be honest. But it is, there are some rough moments throughout this film, peppered in by a little bit of levity. But again, I think that's a lot of like, there's not much dialogue here. And a lot of it's just looking at them and hearing the music, you know?
Yeah. You mentioned the sort of the hope in the last act. And I do think that Naomi Harris delivers this perfectly, but that line of, you don't have to love me, I just need you to know that I love you. I think that line of dialogue also hits pretty hard.
Well, and I think that he has wanted that because she's been ashamed of him. She has expressed shame in him. Mm-hmm. When she realized he was gay, she treated him like he was an anti-gay F word, right? She made him feel that. And I don't think he felt loved. I don't think he knew whether or not she really loved him. And I think you see him cry in that moment as well, because he feels that love. So again, yeah, I think it's one of the other aspects of the hope for him is that they may not be able to forgive each other totally, but they may be able to still reach that love for one another as well.
The only other thing I wanted to say was I gave this a 7.5. So just to close out with the reminder, the ratings and whatnot, I do feel on rewatch for me personally that the last act drags a little bit. I think it's sort of like, not that it limps to the conclusion of the film, but I think they do. And maybe this is what you were saying of there not being a ton of dialogue, but it just feels like we sort of know where this is going, but there's not a ton of like tension. It's more, the last act is purely conversational of him having these powerful conversations. But I do think it, maybe there was room to either trim there, but it feels like the first and second act have sort of story beats to them and moments of tension and not action, but things happening. Whereas the last act does feel purely conversational. It's like wrapping this all up, but it does it over the course of 30 minutes. That's my biggest critique on rewatch, is it does take a little bit to get through that final act for me.
Yeah, I'm going to hard disagree with you there. I'm going to be honest. I think it's a classic denouement. I think it's supposed to do that.
I've never heard of Daniel Ma, but I believe you.
I think it's I think it's needed. I think all those conversations are needed for it to end the way that it does. And I think the pacing is actually in line with it. Mm-hmm. The rest of the film, I think it complements it. And I just think you've had this big climactic moment and now you have to come down from it. And so, yeah, I think the pacing is good personally, but I think it's
a hard disagree with you too. How's it feel?
It feels on brand, you know, brand. It's like we're watching a horror movie all over again. And we just can't agree on it. Yeah.
It's the vibe of the pod.
It's the vibe. Yeah. But anyways, thank you guys for hanging in on this one. I know if you did watch it, hopefully you watched it. If you're here by now, it may have been a hard watch, but it was also, again, I think a really good and important one. Come back next week as we continue June. This is actually our final Juneteenth celebratory film, and we're going to feature some ladies on the pod this time. So this one will be Hidden Figures, which has actually, fun fact, Janelle Monáe in it as well. So,
and Mahershala Ali. We got two and people. And they were both nominated for Best Picture that same year. That's bonkers.
Yeah, they're the magic touch, honestly. But yeah, join us next week for Hidden Figures.
Yeah, and don't forget to like and subscribe on all the social stuff and anywhere that you listen to podcasts. We're on Instagram at We Drink and We Watch Things. So follow us on there, share us, all that good stuff. And yeah, we'll see you next week.
And leave us a review, but you know, only if you like it. That really does help, though. If you like it, to give us a 5-star review. If you don't like it, you don't got to rate it. You don't got to rate it anyway. But for now, you know, go have a drink and watch a thing. Cheers.
Cheers.
Emulating almost exactly who Juan was, right?
His even only... down to the lick lipping.
Right. Lick lipping, the crown on the dash.
Let me say that again. I said lick lipping instead of lip licking. Let me do that again. Sorry.